He had narrowed his scope, eliminated obvious essentials. This was not the Stilgar she remembered.
"We must count on their getting a worm," Paul said. "Whether they can start the melange cycle on another planet is a different question. They'll need more than a worm."
Stilgar looked from brother to sister. Out of ecological thinking that had been ground into him by CH life, he grasped their meaning. A captive worm couldn't live except within a bit of Arrakis, sand plankton, little makers and all. The guild's problem was large, but not impossible. His own growing uncertainty lay in a different area.
"Then your visions do not detect the guild at its work?" he asked.
"Damnation!" Paul exploded.
Aaliyah studied Stilgar, sensing the savage sideshow of ideas taking place in his mind. He was hung on a rack of enchantment. Magic! Magic! To glimpse the future was to steal terrifying fire from a sacred flame. It held the attraction of ultimate peril, souls ventured and lost. One brought back from the formless, dangerous distances something with form and power. But Stilgar was beginning to sense other forces, perhaps greater powers, beyond that unknown horizon. His queen, witch, and sorcerer friend betrayed dangerous weaknesses.
"Stilgar," Aaliyah said, fighting to hold him, "you stand in a valley between dunes. I stand on the crest. I see where you do not see. And among other things, I see mountains which conceal the distances."
"There are things hidden from you," Stilgar said. "This you've always said."
"All power is limited," Aaliyah said.
"And danger may come from behind the mountains," Stilgar said.
"It's something on that order," Aaliyah said.
Stilgar nodded, his gaze fastened on Paul's face.
"But whatever comes from behind the mountains must cross the dunes."
The most dangerous game in the universe is to govern from an oracular base. We do not consider ourselves wise enough or brave enough to play that game. The measures detailed here for regulation in lesser matters are as near as we dare venture to the brink of government. For our purposes, we borrow a definition from the Bene Gesserit, and we consider the various worlds as gene pools, sources of teachings and teachers, sources of the possible. Our goal is not to rule, but to tap these gene pools, to learn and to free ourselves from all restraints imposed by dependency and government. The Orgy as a Tool of Statecraft. Chapter 3 of the Steersman's Guild.
"Is that where your father died?" Edric asked,
sending a beam pointer from his tank to a jeweled marker on one of the relief maps adorning a wall of Paul's reception salon. "That's the shrine of his skull," Paul said. "My father died a prisoner on a Harkonnen frigate in the sink below us."
"Oh yes, I recall the story now," Edric said. "Something about killing the old Baron Harkonnen, his mortal enemy."
Hoping he didn't betray too much of the terror which small enclosures such as this room imposed upon him, Edric rolled over in the orange gas, directed his gaze at Paul, who sat alone on a long divan of striped grey and black. "My sister killed the Baron," Paul said, voice and manner dry, "just before the Battle of Arrakeen." And why, he wondered, did the guild manfish reopen old wounds in this place and at this time? The steersman appeared to be fighting a losing battle to contain his nervous energies. Gone were the languid fish motions of their earlier encounter. Edric's tiny eyes jerked here, there, questing and measuring. The one attendant who had accompanied him in here stood apart near the line of house guards ranging the end wall at Paul's left. The attendant worried Paul, hulking, thick-necked, blunt and vacant face. The man had entered the salon, nudging Edric's tank along on its supporting field, walking with a stranger's gait, arms akimbo. Sightail, Edric had called him. Sightail, an aide. The aide's surface shouted stupidity, but the eyes betrayed him. They laughed at everything they saw.
Your concubine appeared to enjoy the performance of the face dancers, Edric said. It pleases me that I could provide that small entertainment. I particularly enjoyed her reaction to seeing her own features simultaneously repeated by the whole troupe.
Isn't there a warning against guildsmen bearing gifts? Paul asked. And he thought of the performance out there in the great hall. The dancers had entered in the costumes and guise of the Dune Tarot, flinging themselves about in seemingly random patterns that devolved into fire eddies and ancient prognostic designs. Then had come the rulers, a parade of kings and emperors like faces on coins, formal and stiff in outline but curiously fluid. And the jokes, a copy of Paul's own face and body, Chaney repeated across the floor of the hall, even Stilgar, who had grunted and shuddered while others laughed.
But our gifts have the kindest intent, Edric protested.
How kindly can you be? Paul asked. The Gola you gave us believes he was designed to destroy us.
Destroy you, sire? Edric asked, all bland attention. Can one destroy a god?
Stilgar, entering on the last words, stopped, glared at the guards. They were much farther from Paul than he liked. Angrily, he motioned them closer. It's all right still, Paul said, lifting a hand. Just a friendly discussion. Why don't you move the ambassador's tank over by the end of my divan? Stilgar, weighing the order, saw that it would put the steersman's tank between Paul and the hulking aide, much too close to Paul, but... It's all right still, Paul repeated, and he gave the private hand signal which made the order an imperative. Moving with obvious reluctance, Stilgar pushed the tank closer to Paul. He didn't like the feel of the container, or the heavily perfumed smell of melange around it. He took up a position at the corner of the tank beneath the orbiting device through which the steersman spoke. To kill a god, Paul said. That's very interesting. But who says I'm a god?
Those who worship you,
Edric said, glancing pointedly at Stilgar. Is this what you believe? Paul asked.
What I believe is of no moment, sire, Edric said. It seems to most observers, however, that you conspire to make a god of yourself, and one might ask if that is something any mortal can do safely.
Paul studied the guildsman. Repellent creature, but perceptive. It was a question Paul had asked himself time and again, but he had seen enough alternate timelines to know of worse possibilities than accepting godhead for himself. Much worse. These were not, however, the normal avenues for a steersman to probe. Curious. Why had that question been asked? What could Edric hope to gain by such effrontery? Paul's thoughts went, flick, the association of Tlelaxu would be behind this move. Flick, the Jihad's recent Sembu victory would bear on Edric's action. Flick, various Bene Gesserit credos showed themselves here. Flick. A process involving thousands of information bits poured flickering through his computational awareness. It required perhaps 3 seconds. Does a steersman question the guidelines of prescience? Paul asked, putting Edric on the weakest ground. This disturbed the steersman, but he covered well, coming up with what sounded like a long aphorism.
No man of intelligence questions the fact of prescience, sire. Oracular vision has been known to men since most ancient times. It has a way of entangling us when we least suspect. Luckily, there are other forces in our universe.
Greater than prescience? Paul asked, pressing him.
If prescience alone existed and did everything, sire, it would annihilate itself. Nothing but prescience? Where could it be applied except to its own degenerating movements?
There's always the human situation, Paul agreed.
A precarious thing at best, Edric said, without confusing it by hallucinations.
Are my visions no more than hallucinations? Paul asked, mock sadness in his voice. Or do you imply that my worshippers hallucinate? Stilgar, sensing the mounting tensions, moved a step nearer Paul, fixed his attention on the guildsman reclining in the tank.
You twist my words, sire,
Edric protested. An odd sense of violence lay suspended in the words.
Violence here? Paul wondered. They wouldn't dare.
Unless, and he glanced at his guards, the forces which protected him were to be used in replacing him.
But you accuse me of conspiring to make a god of myself, Paul said, pitching his voice that only Edric and Stilgar might hear. Conspire?
A poor choice of words, perhaps, my lord, Edric said.
But significant, Paul said. It says you expect the worst of me.
Edric arched his neck, stared sideways at Stilgar with a look of apprehension.
People always expect the worst of the rich and powerful, sire. It is said one can always tell an aristocrat. He reveals only those of his vices which will make him popular.
A tremor passed across Stilgar's face. Paul looked up at the movement, sensing the thoughts and angers whispering in Stilgar's mind. How dared this guildsman talk thus to Muad'Dib?
You're not joking, of course, Paul said.
Joking, sire?
Paul grew aware of dryness in his mouth. He felt that there were too many people in this room, that the air he breathed had passed through too many lungs. The taint of melange from Edric's tank felt threatening.
Who might my accomplices be in such a conspiracy? Paul asked presently. Do you nominate the Kizarat?
Edric's shrug stirred the orange gas around his head. He no longer appeared concerned by Stilgar, although the Fremen continued to glare at him.
Are you suggesting that my missionaries of the Holy Orders, all of them, are preaching subtle falsehood? Paul insisted.
It could be a question of self-interest and sincerity, Edric said.
Stilgar put a hand to the kris-knife beneath his robe. Paul shook his head, said,
Then you accuse me of insincerity?
I'm not sure that accuse is the proper word, sire.
The boldness of this creature, Paul thought.
And he said, Accused or not, you're saying my bishops and I are no better than power-hungry brigands.
Power-hungry, sire?
Again, Edric looked at Stilgar.
Power tends to isolate those who hold too much of it. Eventually, they lose touch with reality and fall.
My lord, Stilgar growled, you've had men executed for less.
Men, yes, Paul agreed, but this is a guild ambassador.
He accuses you of an unholy fraud, Stilgar said.
His thinking interests me still, Paul said. Contain your anger and remain alert.
As Muad'Dib commands.
Tell me, steersman, Paul said. How could we maintain this hypothetical fraud over such enormous distances of space and time without the means to watch every missionary, to examine every nuance in every Kizarat priory and temple?
What is time to you?
Edric asked. Stilgar frowned in obvious puzzlement, and he thought,
Muad'Dib has often said he sees past the veils of time. What is the guildsman really saying?
Wouldn't the structure of such a fraud begin to show holes? Paul asked. Significant disagreements, schisms, doubts, confessions of guilt. Surely fraud could not suppress all these.
What religion and self-interest cannot hide, governments can, Edric said.
Are you testing the limits of my tolerance? Paul asked.
Do my arguments lack all merit?
Edric countered.
Does he want us to kill him? Paul wondered. Is Edric offering himself as a sacrifice?
I prefer the cynical view, Paul said, testing. You obviously are trained in all the lying tricks of statecraft, the double meanings and the power words. Language is nothing more than a weapon to you, and thus you test my armor.
The cynical view, Edric said, a smile stretching his mouth. And rulers are notoriously cynical where religions are concerned. Religion, too, is a weapon. What manner of weapon is religion when it becomes the government?
Paul felt himself go inwardly still, a profound caution gripping him. To whom was Edric speaking? damnable clever words, heavy with manipulation leverages, that undertone of comfortable humour, the unspoken air of shared secrets. His manner said he and Paul were two sophisticates, men of a wider universe who understood things not granted common folk. With a feeling of shock, Paul realized that he had not been the main target for all this rhetoric. This affliction visited upon the court had been speaking for the benefit of others, speaking to Stilgar, to the household guards, perhaps even to the hulking aid. "Religious mana was thrust upon me," Paul said. "I did not seek it." And he thought, "There, let this manfish think himself victorious in our battle of words."
"Then why have you not disavowed it, sire?" Edric asked.
"Because of my sister Alia," Paul said, watching Edric carefully. "She is a goddess. Let me urge caution where Alia is concerned, lest she strike you dead with her glance." A gloating smile began forming on Edric's mouth, was replaced by a look of shock. "I'm deadly serious," Paul said, watching the shock spread, seeing Stilgar nod. In a bleak voice, Edric said,
"You have mauled my confidence in you, sire, and no doubt that was your intent."
"Do not be certain you know my intent," Paul said, and he signalled Stilgar that the audience was at an end. To Stilgar's questioning gesture, asking if Edric were to be assassinated, Paul gave a negative hand sign, amplified it with an imperative lest Stilgar take matters into his own hands. Sightail, Edric's aide, moved to the rear corner of the tank, nudged it toward the door. When he came opposite Paul, he stopped, turned that laughing gaze on Paul, said,
"If my lord permits."
"Yes, what is it?" Paul asked, noting how Stilgar moved close in answer to the implied menace from this man.
"Some say," Sightail said, "that people cling to imperial leadership because space is infinite. They feel lonely without a unifying symbol. For a lonely people, the Emperor is a definite place. They can turn toward him and say, 'See, there he is. He makes us one.' Perhaps religion serves the same purpose, my lord."
Sightail nodded pleasantly, gave Edric's tank another nudge. They moved out of the salon, Edric supine in his tank, eyes closed. The steersman appeared spent, all his nervous energies exhausted. Paul stared after the shambling figure of Sightail, wondering at the man's words. A peculiar fellow, that Sightail, he thought. While he was speaking, he had radiated a feeling of many people, as though his entire genetic inheritance lay exposed on his skin.
"That was odd,"
Stilgar said, speaking to no one in particular. Paul arose from the divan as a guard closed the door behind Edric and the escort.
"Odd," Stilgar repeated.
A vein throbbed at his temple. Paul dimmed the salon's lights, moved to a window which opened onto an angled cliff of his keep. Lights glittered far below, pygmy movement. A work gang moved down there, bringing giant plasmeld blocks to repair a facade of Alia's temple which had been damaged by a freak twisting of a sandblast wind.
"That was a foolish thing, Usul, inviting that creature into these chambers," Stilgar said.
"Usul," Paul thought, "my Sietch name.
Stilgar reminds me that he ruled over me once, that he saved me from the desert."
"Why did you do it?"
Stilgar asked, speaking from close behind Paul.
"Data," Paul said. "I need more data."
"Is it not dangerous to try meeting this threat only as a mentat?"
That was perceptive, Paul thought. Mentat computation remained finite. You couldn't say something boundless within the boundaries of any language. Mentat abilities had their uses, though. He said as much now, daring Stilgar to refute his argument.
"There's always something outside," Stilgar said. "Some things best kept outside."
"Or inside," Paul said.
And he accepted for a moment his own oracular mentat summation. Outside, yes. And inside. Here lay the true horror. How could he protect himself from himself? They certainly were setting him up to destroy himself, but this was a position hemmed in by even more terrifying possibilities. His reverie was broken by the sound of rapid footsteps. The figure of Korba, the Kizara, surged through the doorway, backlighted by the brilliant illumination in the hallways. He entered as though hurled by an unseen force and came to an almost immediate halt when he encountered the salon's gloom. His hands appeared to be full of shigawire reels. They glittered in the light from the hall, strange little round jewels that were extinguished as a guardsman's hand came into view, closed the door.
"Is that you, my lord?" Korba asked, peering into the shadows.
"What is it?" Stilgar asked.
"Stilgar?"
"We're both here. What is it?"
"I'm disturbed by this reception for the guildsman."
"Disturbed?" Paul asked.
"The people say, my lord, that you honor our enemies."
"Is that all?" Paul said. "Are those the reels I asked you to bring earlier?" He indicated the shigawire orbs in Korba's hands.
"Reels? Oh, yes, my lord. These are the histories. Will you view them here?"
"I viewed them. I want them for Stilgar here."
"For me?" Stilgar asked.
He felt resentment grow at what he interpreted as caprice on Paul's part. Histories. Stilgar had sought out Paul earlier to discuss the logistics computations for the Zabulon conquest. The guild ambassador's presence had intervened. And now, Korba with histories. "How much history do you know?" Paul mused aloud, studying the shadowy figure beside him.
"My lord, I can name every world our people touched in their migrations. I know the reaches of Imperial."
"The Golden Age of Earth. Have you ever studied that?"
"Earth? Golden Age?"
Stilgar was irritated and puzzled. Why would Paul wish to discuss myths from the dawn of time? Stilgar's mind still felt crammed with Zabulon data, computations from the staff Mentats, 205 attack frigates with 30 legions, support battalions, pacification cadres, Kizarat missionaries, the food requirements, he had the figures right here in his mind, and melange, weaponry, uniforms, medals, urns for the ashes of the dead, the number of specialists, men to produce raw materials of propaganda, clerks, accountants, spies, and spies upon the spies.
"I brought the pulse synchronizer attachment also, my lord," Korba ventured.
He obviously sensed the tensions building between Paul and Stilgar and was disturbed by them. Stilgar shook his head from side to side.
"Pulse synchronizer?
Why would Paul wish him to use a mnemonic flutter system on a shigawire projector? Why scan for specific data in histories? This was meant at work. As usual, Stilgar found he couldn't escape a deep suspicion at the thought of using a projector and attachments. The thing always immersed him in disturbing sensations, an overwhelming shower of data which his mind sorted out later, surprising him with information he had not known he possessed.
"Sire, I came with the Zabulon computations," Stilgar said.
"Dehydrate the Zabulon computations," Paul snapped, using the obscene Fremen term which meant that here was moisture no man could demean himself by touching.
"My lord!"
"Stilgar," Paul said, "you urgently need a sense of balance which can come only from an understanding of long-term effects. What little information we have about the old times, the pittance of data which the Butlerians left us, Korba has brought it for you. Start with the Genghis Khan."
"Genghis Khan? Was he of the Saduqa, my lord?"
"Oh, long before that. He killed perhaps 4 million.
"He must have had formidable weaponry to kill that many, sire. Lesbeams, perhaps, or—"
"He didn't kill them himself still. He killed the way I kill, by sending out his legions. There's another emperor I want you to note in passing, a Hitler. He killed more than 6 million. Pretty good for those days."
"Killed? By his legions?" Stilgar asked.
"Yes."
"Not very impressive statistics, my lord."
"Very good still." Paul glanced at the reels in Korba's hands. Korba stood with them as though he wished he could drop them and flee. "Statistics. At a conservative estimate, I've killed 61 billion, sterilized 90 planets, completely demoralized 500 others. I've wiped out the followers of 40 religions which had existed since—"
"Unbelievers!"
Cobber protested. Unbelievers all!
No, Paul said. Believers.
My liege makes a joke,
Cobber said, voice trembling.
The jihad has brought 10,000 worlds into the shining light of...
Into the darkness, Paul said. We'll be 100 generations recovering from Muad Dib's jihad. I find it hard to imagine that anyone will ever surpass this.
A barking laugh erupted from his throat.
What amuses Muad Dib?
Stilgar asked.
I'm not amused. I merely had a sudden vision of the Emperor Hitler saying something similar. No doubt he did.
No other ruler ever had your powers,
Corba argued.
Who would dare challenge you? Your legions control the known universe, and all the...
The legions control, Paul said. I wonder if they know this.
You control your legions, sire,
Stilgar interrupted. And it was obvious from the tone of his voice that he suddenly felt his own position in that chain of command, his own hand guiding all that power. Having set Stilgar's thoughts in motion along the track he wanted, Paul turned his full attention to Corba, said,
Put the reels here on the divan.
As Corba obeyed, Paul said,
How goes the reception, Corba? Does my sister have everything well in hand?
Yes, my lord.
Corba's tone was wary.
And Chaney watches from the spy hole. She suspects there may be Saduka in the guild entourage.
No doubt she's correct, Paul said. The jackals gather.
Banerjee,
Stilgar said, naming the chief of Paul's security detail,
was worried earlier that some of them might try to penetrate the private areas of the keep.
Have they?
Not yet.
But there was some confusion in the formal gardens,
Corba said.
What sort of confusion?
Stilgar demanded. Paul nodded.
Strangers coming and going, Corba said. Trampling the plants, whispering conversations. I heard reports of some disturbing remarks.
Such as? Paul asked.
Is this the way our taxes are spent? I'm told the ambassador himself asked that question.
I don't find that surprising, Paul said. Were there many strangers in the gardens?
Dozens, my lord.
Banerjee stationed picked troopers at the vulnerable doors, my lord,
Stilgar said. He turned as he spoke, allowing the salon's single remaining light to illuminate half his face. The peculiar lighting, the face, all touched a node of memory in Paul's mind, something from the desert. Paul didn't bother bringing it to full recall, his attention being focused on how Stilgar had pulled back mentally. The Fremen had a tight-skinned forehead which mirrored almost every thought flickering across his mind. He was suspicious now, profoundly suspicious of his emperor's odd behavior.
I don't like the intrusion into the gardens, Paul said. Courtesy to guests is one thing, and the formal necessities of greeting an envoy. But this...
I'll see to removing them, Corba said. Immediately.
Wait, Paul ordered, as Corba started to turn.
In the abrupt stillness of the moment, Stilgar edged himself into a position where he could study Paul's face. It was deftly done. Paul admired the way of it, an achievement devoid of any forwardness. It was a Fremen thing, slyness touched by respect for another's privacy, a movement of necessity.
What time is it? Paul asked.
Almost midnight, sir,
Corba said.
Corba, I think you may be my finest creation, Paul said.
Sire!
There was injury in Corba's voice.
Do you feel awe of me? Paul asked.
You are Paul Muad Dib, who was Usul in our siege, Corba said. You know my devotion to...
Have you ever felt like an apostle? Paul asked.
Corba obviously misunderstood the words, but correctly interpreted the tone.
My emperor knows I have a clean conscience.
Shai Hulud save us, Paul murmured.
The questioning silence of the moment was broken by the sound of someone whistling as he walked down the outer hall. The whistling was stilled by a guardsman's barked command as it came opposite the door.
Corba, I think you may survive all this, Paul said, and he read the growing light of understanding on Stilgar's face.
The strangers in the garden, sire?
Stilgar asked.
Ah, yes, Paul said. Have Banerjee put them out still. Korba will assist.
Me, sire?
Korba betrayed deep disquiet. Some of my friends have forgotten they once were Fremen, Paul said, speaking to Korba, but designing his words for Stilgar. You will mark down the ones Chaney identifies as Sardaukar, and you will have them killed. Do it yourself. I want it done quietly and without undue disturbance. We must keep in mind that there's more to religion and government than approving treaties and sermons.
I obey the orders of Muad'Dib, Korba whispered.
The Zabulon computations? Stilgar asked. Tomorrow, Paul said. And when the strangers are removed from the gardens, announce that the reception is ended. The party's over still.
I understand, my lord.
I'm sure you do, Paul said. Here lies a toppled god. His fall was not a small one. We did but build his pedestal a narrow and a tall one. Tlelaxu epigram. Alia crouched, resting elbows on knees, chin on fists, stared at the body on the dune, a few bones and some tattered flesh that once had been a young woman. The hands, the head, most of the upper torso were gone, eaten by the Coriolis wind. The sand all around bore the tracks of her brother's medics and questors. They were gone now, all excepting the mortuary attendants who stood to one side, with Hate, the Gola, waiting for her to finish her mysterious perusal of what had been written here. A wheat-coloured sky enfolded the scene in the glaucous light common to mid-afternoon for these latitudes. The body had been discovered several hours earlier by a low-flying courier whose instruments had detected a faint water trace where none should be. His call had brought the experts, and they had learned, what? That this had been a woman of about 20 years, Fremen, addicted to Semuta, and she had died here in the crucible of the desert from the effects of a subtle poison of Tlelaxu origin. To die in the desert was a common enough occurrence, but a Fremen addicted to Semuta, this was such a rarity that Paul had sent her to examine the seed in the ways their mother had taught them. Alia felt that she had accomplished nothing here except to cast her own aura of mystery about a scene that was already mysterious enough. She heard the Gola's feet stir the sand, looked at him. His attention rested momentarily upon the escort thopters circling overhead like a flock of ravens. Beware of the guild bearing gifts, Alia thought. The mortuary thopter and her own craft stood on the sand near a rock outcropping behind the Gola. Focusing on the grounded thopters filled Alia with a craving to be airborne and away from here. But Paul had thought she might see something here which others would miss. She squirmed in her stillsuit. It felt raspingly unfamiliar after all the suitless months of city life. She studied the Gola, wondering if he might know something important about this peculiar death. A lock of his black goat hair, she saw, had escaped his stillsuit hood. She sensed her hand longing to tuck that hair back into place. As though lured by this thought, his gleaming grey metal eyes turned toward her. The eyes set her trembling, and she tore her gaze away from him. A Fremen woman had died here from a poison called the Throat of Hell. A Fremen addicted to Semuta. She shared Paul's disquiet at this conjunction. The mortuary attendants waited patiently. This corpse contained not enough water for them to salvage. They felt no need to hurry, and they'd believe that Alia, through some glyptic art, was reading a strange truth in these remains. No strange truth came to her. There was only a distant feeling of anger deep within her at the obvious thoughts in the attendants' minds. It was a product of the damned religious mystery. She and her brother could not be people. They had to be something more. The Bene Gesserit had seen to that by manipulating Atreides' ancestry. Their mother had contributed to it by thrusting them onto the path of witchery. And Paul perpetuated the difference. The Reverend Mothers, encapsulated in Alia's memories, stirred restlessly, provoking Adab flashes of thought. Peace, little one. You are what you are. There are compensations.
compensations. She summoned the Gola with a gesture. He stopped beside her, attentive, patient.
What do you see in this? She asked.
We may never learn who it was died here, he said. The head, the teeth are gone, the hands. Unlikely such a one had a genetic record somewhere to which her cells could be matched.
Tleilaxu poison, she said. What do you make of that?
Many people buy such poisons.
True enough. And this flesh is too far gone to be regrown as was done with your body.
Even if you could trust the Tleilaxu to do it, he said. She nodded, stood.
You will fly me back to the city now.
When they were airborne and pointed north, she said,
You fly exactly as Duncan Idaho did.
He cast a speculative glance at her.
Others have told me this.
What are you thinking now? She asked.
Many things.
Stop dodging my question, damn you.
Which question?
She glared at him. He saw the glare. Shrugged. How like Duncan Idaho, that gesture, she thought. Accusingly, her voice thick and with a catch in it, she said,
I merely wanted your reactions voiced to play my own thoughts against them. That young woman's death bothers me.
I was not thinking about that.
What were you thinking about?
About the strange emotions I feel when people speak of the one I may have been.
May have been?
The Tleilaxu are very clever.
Not that clever. You were Duncan Idaho.
Very likely. It's the prime computation.
So you get emotional?
To a degree. I feel eagerness. I'm uneasy. There's a tendency to tremble, and I must devote effort to controlling it. I get flashes of imagery.
What imagery?
It's too rapid to recognize. Flashes, spasms, almost memories.
Aren't you curious about such memories?
Of course. Curiosity urges me forward. But I move against a heavy reluctance. I think, what if I'm not the one they believe me to be? I don't like that thought.
And this is all you were thinking?
You know better than that, Aaliyah.
How dare he use my given name?
She felt anger rise and go down beneath the memory of the way he'd spoken. Softly throbbing undertones, casual male confidence. A muscle twitched along her jaw. She clenched her teeth.
Isn't that Elkud's down there?
He asked, dipping a wing briefly, causing a sudden flurry in their escort. She looked down at their shadows rippling across the promontory above Harg Pass, at the cliff and the rock pyramid containing the skull of her father. El Quds, the holy place.
That's the holy place, she said.
I must visit that place one day, he said. Nearness to your father's remains may bring memories I can capture.
She saw suddenly how strong must be this need to know who he'd been. It was a central compulsion with him. She looked back at the rocks, the cliff with its base sloping into a dry beach, and a sea of sand, cinnamon rock lifting from the dunes like a ship breasting waves.
Circle back, she said.
The escort.
They'll follow. Swing under them.
He obeyed.
Do you truly serve my brother?
She asked, when he was on the new course, the escort following.
I serve the Atreides, he said, his tone formal.
And she saw his right hand lift, fall, almost the old salute of Caladan. A pensive look came over his face. She watched him peer down at the rock pyramid.
What bothers you? She asked.
His lips moved. A voice emerged, brittle, tight.
He was...
A tear slid down his cheek. Aaliyah found herself stilled by Fremen awe.
He gave water to the dead.
Compulsively, she touched a finger to his cheek, felt the tear.
Duncan, she whispered.
He appeared locked to the Thopter's controls, gaze fastened to the tomb below. She raised her voice.
Duncan.
He swallowed, shook his head, looked at her, the metal eyes glistening.
I felt... An arm on my shoulder, he whispered. I felt it. An arm.
His throat worked.
It was a friend. It was my friend.
Who?
I don't know. I think it was... I don't know.
The call light began flashing in front of Aaliyah, their escort captain wanting to know why they returned to the desert. She took the microphone, explained that they had paid a brief homage to her father's tomb. The captain reminded her that it was late. "We will go to Arakeen now," she said, replacing the microphone. Haight took a deep breath, banked their thopter around to the north.
"It was my father's arm you felt, wasn't it?" she asked.
"Perhaps."
His voice was that of the Mentat computing probabilities, and she saw he had regained his composure.
"Are you aware of how I know my father?" she asked.
"I have some idea."
"Let me make it clear," she said.
Briefly, she explained how she had awakened to Reverend Mother awareness before birth, a terrified fetus with the knowledge of countless lives embedded in her nerve cells, and all this after the death of her father.
"I know my father as my mother knew him," she said, "in every last detail of every experience she shared with him. In a way, I am my mother. I have all her memories up to the moment when she drank the water of life and entered the trance of transmigration."
"Your brother explained something of this."
"He did? Why?"
"I asked."
"Why?"
"A Mentat requires data."
"Oh."
She looked down at the flat expanse of the shield wall, tortured rock, pits and crevices. He saw the direction of her gaze, said,
"A very exposed place, that down there."
"But an easy place to hide," she said.
She looked at him.
"It reminds me of a human mind with all its concealments."
"Ah," he said.
"Ah? What does that mean, ah?"
She was suddenly angry with him, and the reason for it escaped her.
"You'd like to know what my mind conceals," he said.
It was a statement, not a question.
"How do you know I haven't exposed you for what you are by my powers of prescience?" she demanded.
"Have you?"
He seemed genuinely curious.
"No."
"Sibyls have limits," he said.
He appeared to be amused, and this reduced Aaliyah's anger.
"Amused? Have you no respect for my powers?" she asked.
The question sounded weakly argumentative, even to her own ears.
"I respect your omens and portents perhaps more than you think," he said. "I was in the audience for your morning ritual."
"And what does that signify?"
"You've great ability with symbols," he said,
keeping his attention on the thopter's controls.
"That's a Bene Gesserit thing, I'd say. But as with many witches, you've become careless of your powers."
She felt a spasm of fear, blared,
"How dare you?"
"I dare much more than my makers anticipated," he said. "Because of that rare fact, I remain with your brother."
Aaliyah studied the steel balls which were his eyes. No human expression there. The stillsuit hood concealed the line of his jaw. His mouth remained firm, though. Great strength in it, and determination. His words had carried a reassuring intensity. "Dare much more." That was a thing Duncan Idaho might have said. Had the Tlilaxu fashioned their gula better than they knew? Or was this mere sham, part of his conditioning?
"Explain yourself, gula," she commanded.
"Know thyself. Is that thy commandment?" he asked.
Again she felt that he was amused.
"Don't bandy words with me, you thing," she said.
She put a hand to the kris knife in its throat sheath.
"Why were you given to my brother?"
"Your brother tells me that you watched the presentation," he said. "You've heard me answer that question for him."
"Answer it again, for me."
"I am intended to destroy him."
"Is that the Mentat speaking?"
"You know the answer to that without asking," he chided. "And you know as well that such a gift wasn't necessary. Your brother already was destroying himself quite adequately."
She weighed these words, her hand remaining on the haft of her knife. A tricky answer, but there was sincerity in the voice.
"Then why such a gift?" she probed.
"It may have amused the Tlilaxu, and it is true that the guild asked for me as a gift."
"Why?"
"Same answer."
"How am I careless of my powers?"
"How are you employing them?"
he countered. His question slashed through to her own misgivings. She took her hand away from the knife, asked, "Why do you say my brother was destroying himself?"
"Oh, come now, child. Where are these vaunted powers? Have you no ability to reason?"
Controlling anger, she said, "Reason for me, Mentat."
"Very well."
He glanced around at their escort, returned his attention to their course. The plain of Arakeen was beginning to show beyond the northern rim of the shield wall. The pattern of the Pan and Graben villages remained indistinct beneath a dust pall, but the distant gleam of Arakeen could be discerned.
"Symptoms," he said.
"Your brother keeps an official panegyrist who
was a gift of the Fremen Naibs."
"An odd gift from friends," he said. "Why would they surround him with flattery and servility?
Have you really listened to this panegyrist?"
"The people are illuminated by Muad'Dib. The Ummah regent, our emperor, came out of darkness to shine resplendently upon all men. He is our sire. He is precious water from an endless fountain. He spills joy for all the universe to drink. Pah!"
Speaking softly, Alia said,
"If I but repeated your words for our Fremen escort, they'd hack you into bird feed."
"Then tell them."
"My brother rules by the natural law of heaven."
"You don't believe that. So why say it?"
"How do you know what I believe?"
She experienced trembling that no Bene Gesserit powers could control. This Gola was having an effect she hadn't anticipated.
"You commanded me to reason as a Mentat," he reminded her.
"No Mentat knows what I believe."
She took two deep, shuddering breaths.
"How dare you judge us?"
"Judge you? I don't judge."
"You've no idea how we were taught."
"Both of you were taught to govern," he said. "You were conditioned to an overweening thirst for power. You were imbued with a shrewd grasp of politics and a deep understanding for the uses of war and ritual."
"Natural law?
What natural law? That myth haunts human history."
"Haunts? It's a ghost. It's insubstantial, unreal. Is your jihad a natural law?"
"Mentat jabber," she sneered.
"I'm a servant of the Atreides, and I speak with candor," he said.
"Servant? We've no servants, only disciples."
"And I am a disciple of awareness," he said. "Understand that, child, and you—"
"Don't call me child," she snapped.
She slipped her kris knife half out of its sheath.
"I stand corrected."
He glanced at her, smiled, returned his attention to piloting the Thopter. The cliff-sided structure of the Atreides keep could be made out now, dominating the northern suburbs of Arakeen.
"You are something ancient in flesh that is little more than a child," he said. "And the flesh is disturbed by its new womanhood."
"I don't know why I listen to you," she growled.
But she let the kris knife fall back into its sheath, wiped her palm on her robe. The palm, wet with perspiration, disturbed her sense of Fremen frugality. Such a waste of the body's moisture.
"You listen because you know I'm devoted to your brother," he said. "My actions are clear and easily understood."
"Nothing about you is clear and easily understood. You're the most complex creature I've ever seen. How do I know what the Tlelaxu built into you?"
"By mistake or intent," he said. "They gave me freedom to mould myself."
"You retreat into Zensunni parables," she accused. "The wise man moulds himself, the fool lives only to die."
Her voice was heavy with mimicry.
"Disciple of awareness."
"Men cannot separate means and enlightenment," he said.
"You speak riddles."
"I speak to the opening mind."
"I'm going to repeat all this to Paul."
"He's heard most of it already."
She found herself overwhelmed by curiosity.
"How is it you're still alive and free? What did he say?"
"He laughed, and he said, 'People don't want a bookkeeper for an emperor. They want a master, someone who'll protect them from change.' But he agreed that destruction of his empire arises from himself."
"Why would he say such things?"
"Because I convinced him I understand his problem and will help him."
"What could you possibly have said to do that?"
He remained silent, banking the Thopter into the downwind leg for a landing at the guard complex on the roof of the keep.
I demand you tell me what you said.
I'm not sure you could take it.
I'll be the judge of that. I command you to speak at once.
Permit me to land us first, he said. And not waiting for her permission, he turned onto the base leg, brought the wings into optimum lift, settled gently onto the bright orange pad atop the roof.
Now, Alia said, speak.
I told him that to endure oneself may be the hardest task in the universe.
She shook her head.
That's...
A bitter pill, he said,
watching the guards run toward them across the roof, taking up their escort positions.
Bitter nonsense.
The greatest Palatinate earl and the lowliest stipendiary serf share the same problem. You cannot hire a mentat or any other intellect to solve it for you. There's no writ of inquest or calling of witnesses to provide answers. No servant or disciple can dress the wound. You dress it yourself or continue bleeding for all to see.
She whirled away from him, realizing in the instant of action what this betrayed about her own feelings. Without wile of voice or witch-wrought trickery, he had reached into her psyche once more.
How did he do this? What have you told him to do? She whispered.
I told him to judge, to impose order.
Alia stared out at the guard, marking how patiently they waited, how orderly.
To dispense justice, she murmured.
Not that, he snapped. I suggested that he judge no more, guided by one principle, perhaps.
And that?
To keep his friends and destroy his enemies.
To judge unjustly, then.
What is justice? Two forces collide. Each may have the right in his own sphere. And here's where an emperor commands orderly solutions. Those collisions he cannot prevent, he solves.
How?
In the simplest way. He decides.
Keeping his friends and destroying his enemies.
Isn't that stability? People want order, this kind or some other. They sit in the prison of their hungers and see that war has become the sport of the rich. That's a dangerous form of sophistication. It's disorderly.
I will suggest to my brother that you are much too dangerous and must be destroyed, she said, turning to face him.
A solution I've already suggested, he said.
And that's why you are dangerous, she said, measuring out her words. You've mastered your passions.
That is not why I'm dangerous.
Before she could move, he leaned across, gripped her chin in one hand, planted his lips on hers. It was a gentle kiss, brief. He pulled away and she stared at him with a shock, leavened by glimpses of spasmodic grins on the faces of her guardsmen still standing at orderly attention outside. Alia put a finger to her lips. There had been such a sense of familiarity about that kiss. His lips had been flesh of a future she'd seen in some prescient byway. Breast heaving, she said,
I should have you flayed.
Because I'm dangerous?
Because you presume too much.
I presume nothing. I take nothing which is not first offered to me. Be glad I did not take all that was offered.
He opened his door, slid out.
Come along. We've dallied too long on a fool's errand.
He strode toward the entrance dome beyond the pad. Alia leaped out, ran to match his stride.
I'll tell him everything you've said and everything you did, she said.
Good.
He held the door for her.
He will order you executed, she said,
slipping into the dome.
Why? Because I took the kiss I wanted?
He followed her, his movement forcing her back. The door slid closed behind him.
The kiss you wanted?
Outrage filled her.
All right, Alia, the kiss you wanted then.
He started to move around her toward the drop field. As though his movement had propelled her into heightened awareness, she realized his candor, the utter truthfulness of him.
The kiss I wanted, she told herself. True. Your truthfulness, that's what's dangerous, she said, following him.
You return to the ways of wisdom, he said, not breaking his stride. A mentat could not have stated the matter more directly. Now, what is it you saw in the desert?
She grabbed his arm, forcing him to a halt. He'd done it again, shocked her mind into sharpened awareness.
I can't explain it, she said, but I keep thinking of the face dancers. Why is that?
That is why your brother sent you to the desert, he said, nodding. Tell him of this persistent thought.
But why?
She shook her head.
Why face dancers?
There's a young woman dead out there, he said. Perhaps no young woman is reported missing among the Fremen.
I think what a joy it is to be alive, and I wonder if I'll ever leap inward to the root of this flesh and know myself as once I was. The root is there. Whether any act of mine can find it, that remains tangled in the future. But all things a man can do are mine. Any act of mine may do it. The Gula speaks. Aaliyah's commentary.
As he lay immersed in the screaming odour of the spice, staring inward through the oracular trance, Paul saw the moon become an elongated sphere. It rolled and twisted, hissing, the terrible hissing of a star being quenched in an infinite sea, down, 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 like a ball thrown by a child. It was gone. This moon had not set. Realization engulfed him. It was gone. No moon. The earth quaked like an animal shaking its skin. Terror swept over him. Paul jerked upright on his pallet, eyes wide open, staring. Part of him looked outward, part inward. Outwardly, he saw the plasmeld grillwork which vented his private room, and he knew he lay beside a stone-like abyss of his keep. Inwardly, he continued to see the moon fall.
Out! Out!
His grillwork of plasmeld looked onto the blazing light of noon across Arakene. Inward, there lay blackest night. A shower of sweet odours from a garden roof nibbled at his senses, but no floral perfume could roll back that fallen moon. Paul swung his feet to the cold surface of the floor, peered through the grillwork. He could see directly across to the gentle arc of a footbridge constructed of crystal stabilised gold and platinum. Fire jewels from far Sedon decorated the bridge. It led to the galleries of the inner city across a pool and fountain filled with waterflowers. If he stood, Paul knew, he could look down into petals as clean and red as fresh blood whirling, turning there, discs of ambient colour tossed on an emerald freshet. His eyes absorbed the scene without pulling him from spice thraldom.
That terrible vision of a lost moon.
The vision suggested a monstrous loss of individual security. Perhaps he'd seen his civilization fall, toppled by its own pretensions. A moon. A moon. A falling moon. It had taken a massive dose of the spice essence to penetrate the mud thrown up by the taro. All it had shown him was a falling moon and the hateful way he'd known from the beginning. To buy an end for the jihad, to silence the volcano of butchery, he must discredit himself.
Disengage, disengage, disengage.
Floral perfume from the garden roof reminded him of Chaney. He longed for her arms now, for the clinging arms of love and forgetfulness. But even Chaney could not exorcise this vision. What would Chaney say if he went to her with a statement that he had a particular death in mind? Knowing it to be inevitable, why not choose an aristocrat's death, ending life on a secret flourish, squandering any years that might have been? To die before coming to the end of willpower, was that not an aristocrat's choice? He stood, crossed to the lapped opening in the grillwork, went out onto a balcony which looked upward to flowers and vines trailing from the garden. His mouth held the dryness of a desert march.
Moon. Moon, where is that moon?
He thought of Aaliyah's description, the young woman's body found in the dunes, a Fremen addicted to Semuta. Everything fitted the hateful pattern.
You do not take from this universe, he thought. It grants what it will.
The remains of a conch shell from the seas of Mother Earth lay on a low table beside the balcony rail. He took its lustrous smoothness into his hands, tried to feel backward in time. The pearl surface reflected glittering moons of light. He tore his gaze from it, peered upward past the garden to a sky become a conflagration, trails of rainbow dust shining in the silver sun. My Fremen call themselves Children of the Moon, he thought. He put down the conch, strode along the balcony. Did that terrifying moon hold out hope of escape? He probed for meaning in the region of mystic communion. He felt weak, shaken, still gripped by the spice. At the north end of his plasmeld chasm, he came in sight of the lower buildings of the government warren. Foot traffic thronged the roof walks. He felt that the people moved there like a frieze against the background of doors, walls, tile designs. The people were tiles. When he blinked, he could hold them frozen in his mind. A freeze. A moon falls and is gone. A feeling came over him that the city out there had been translated into an odd symbol for his universe. The buildings he could see had been erected on the plain where his Fremen had obliterated the Sardaukar legions. Ground once trampled by battles rang now to the rushing clamour of business. Keeping to the balcony's outer edge, Paul strode around the corner. Now his vista was a suburb where city structures lost themselves in rocks and the blowing sand of the desert. Alia's temple dominated the foreground. Green and black hangings along its 2,000-meter sides displayed the moon symbol of Muad'Dib. A falling moon. Paul passed a hand across his forehead and eyes. The symbol metropolis oppressed him. He despised his own thoughts. Such vacillation in another would have aroused his anger. He loathed his city. Rage, rooted in boredom, flickered and simmered deep within him, nurtured by decisions that couldn't be avoided. He knew which path his feet must follow. He'd seen it enough times, hadn't he? Seen it. Once, long ago, he'd thought of himself as an inventor of government. But the invention had fallen into old patterns. It was like some hideous contrivance with plastic memory. Shape it any way you wanted, but relax for a moment and it snapped into the ancient forms. Forces at work beyond his reach in human breasts eluded and defied him. Paul stared out across the rooftops. What treasures of untrammeled life lay beneath those roofs? He glimpsed leaf-green places, open plantings amidst the chalk red and gold of the roofs. Green, the gift of Muad'Dib and his water. Orchards and groves lay within his view, open plantings to rival those of fabled Lebanon.
Muad'Dib spends water like a madman, Fremen said.
Paul put his hands over his eyes.
The moon fell.
He dropped his hands, stared at his metropolis with clarified vision. Buildings took on an aura of monstrous imperial barbarity. They stood enormous and bright beneath the northern sun. Colossi. Every extravagance of architecture a demented history could produce lay within his view. Terraces of mesa proportion, squares as large as some cities, parks, premises, bits of cultured wilderness. Superb artistry abutted inexplicable prodigies of dismal tastelessness. Details impressed themselves upon him, a postern out of most ancient Baghdad, a dome dreamed in mythical Damascus, an arch from the low gravity of Attar, harmonious elevations and queer depths, all created an effect of unrivaled magnificence.
A moon, a moon, a moon!
Frustration tangled him. He felt the pressure of mass unconscious, that burgeoning sweep of humankind across his universe. They rushed upon him with a force like a gigantic tidal bore. He sensed the vast migrations at work in human affairs, eddies, currents, gene flows, no dams of abstinence, no seizures of impotence nor maledictions could stop it. Muad Dib's jihad was less than an eye-blink in this larger movement. The Bene Gesserit swimming in this tide, that corporate entity trading in genes, was trapped in the torrent as he was. Visions of a falling moon must be measured against other legends, other visions in a universe where even the seemingly eternal stars waned, flickered, died. What mattered a single moon in such a universe? Far within his fortress citadel, so deep within that the sound sometimes lost itself in the flow of city noises, a 10-string rebaba tinkled with a song of the jihad, a lament for a woman left behind on Arrakis. Her hips are dunes curved by the wind, her eyes shine like summer heat. 2 braids of hair hang down her back, rich with water rings her hair. My hands remember her skin, fragrant as amber, flower-scented. Eyelids tremble with memories. I am stricken by love's white flame. The song sickened him. A tune for stupid creatures lost in sentimentality, as well sing to the dune-impregnated corpse Alia had seen. A figure moved in shadows on the balcony's grillwork. Paul whirled. The Gola emerged into the sun's full glare, his metal eyes glittering. "Is it Duncan Idaho, or the man called Hate?" Paul asked. The Gola came to a stop 2 paces from him. "Which would my lord prefer?" The voice carried a soft ring of caution. "Play the Zen Sunni," Paul said bitterly. Meanings within meanings. What could a Zen Sunni philosopher say or do to change one jot of the reality unrolling before them at this instant? "My lord is troubled." Paul turned away, stared at the shield wall's distant scarp, saw wind-carved arches and buttresses, terrible mimicry of his city. Nature playing a joke on him. "See what I can build?" He recognized a slash in the distant massif, a place where sand spilled from a crevasse, and thought, "There, right there, we fought Sardauka." "What troubles, my lord?" the Gola asked.
"A vision," Paul whispered.
"Ah, when the Tlelaxu first awakened me, I had visions. I was restless, lonely. Not really knowing I was lonely. Not then. My visions revealed nothing. The Tlelaxu told me it was